Love is something we talk about all the time, yet I'm afraid that many of us do not really understand it. Part of the reason is we think of love as an emotion. Love is not an emotion, it is an action. Now, as an action, it involves the total person, therefore can involve our emotions, but we've got to remember, first of all, it is an action. It's interesting to note in the Greek that love is always an action verb. It is not just a feeling, it is movement, it's doing something. I think part of the reason we have so much difficulty understanding what love is that most of us try to define love within the terms of its relationship and use this as a way of describing its intensity. For instance, we think of that love between a parent and child or husband and wife as being the deepest kind of love. No, that's not really where it is. All we're doing there is describing the kind of relationship, because love, like a fluid, takes the shape of the vessel or the relationship. When I talk about a friendship, what I'm saying is this is a love between two people who share common likes. We have the same likes for food or the same likes for hobbies, and therefore we become friends. We like one another. If I turn and talk about family love, I'm talking about a love that takes its shape out of the fact that we have a common heritage. Somewhere along the line, there are parents or grandparents or great-grandparents that bring us together into a bond or a tie. Police officers detest domestic quarrels, especially between two brothers. They'll be about to kill each other, but you let the policeman walk in between them, and what happens? They both turn on the police officer because that's my brother. You can't do anything to him. That's my brother. Then we start talking about parental love. And what we're talking about in parental love is, as I look at my child, I see me. As the child looks at me, they see themselves, because we have a common tie in that we are part of each other. The child's a part of me. The child sees himself in me, and we relate to each other out of that tie. That's the reason why we have such strong reactions to our children. We love them because they're us, but sometimes we get so frustrated with them because they are too much like us and they have the same faults that we have. And so we become very frustrated. But there is that tie. And then there is romantic love. Romantic love is that tie of companionship. We'll talk more about that when we talk about the battle between the sexes. That is, that person who complements me, balances me, makes me complete or whole. And you can love a person deeply without being, quote, in love with them, or without being romantically involved with them. Have a deep, compassionate love for that person. When I start talking about the intensity of love, rather than trying to define it within the form of its relationship, knowing that if I understand the nature of love, then I can apply it to whatever relationship I may find myself in, I like to think of love in degrees. It's like being able to love 100 degrees of love, 100 units of love. That first third, that first level, if you will, is eros, or selfish love. Some people want to limit eros in the Greek to physical or sexual love. I personally believe that it goes beyond that. It speaks of a particular type of love, because sexual love can be on any one of these three levels. Eros speaks of a selfish love that says, meet my needs. That is where all of us begin. You doubt that? Look at a little baby. I'm hungry. Wah, feed me. I'm dirty. Wah, change me. Meet my needs. Meet my needs. In other words, they're just crying out, meet my needs. Prima donnas are people who are still selfishly saying, meet my needs, and are not realizing there is also a level of love that says, I reach out to you in a swap love, and that's the second level. The word phileo, brotherly love, speaks of a swap love. It's a love that says, I love you if you're good, if you love me, if I think you'll love me. But if you don't love me, I don't love you. Now, I'll ask you a simple question. How many of you think your employer gives you a paycheck when you have worked for that person 40 hours giving them sweat and energy and brilliance. No, you're swapping your intelligence, your effort, for the paycheck. When you go across the store to the grocery store to get a loaf of bread, do they give it to you? No, you swap bread for bread. It's a swap out. And that's where most of us live our lives. As a matter of fact, that is the highest form of purely human love. But there's a third level. You got the first one, the first third of it, is that selfish love. Then you've got that swap love. And then you get the gift love. The difference between gift love and swap love is the word if, the condition. Gift love says, I love you, therefore I give according to my ability to meet your needs. If I have what you have need of, then it is my privilege to give it to you. I believe that the only way you and I can ever live agape or gift love is through a personal relationship with God, because I need to be loved as well as to love. And I have a fear that if I go around giving away my love, one of these days I will awaken and realize that I have given all my love away and nothing has been given back to me. So what I do is, I just work a little deal with you. I'll give you a little if you give me a little. I'll swap a little with you and you swap a little with me. We go around kind of satisfying each other by swapping. But when you and I come to that place that we have that personal faith in God, then we can say, I can give because I know that though you may not give back, you may not reciprocate, God in his love for me will never allow me to be unloved. He will always speak to us that somehow or another my need to be loved is met. Therefore, through faith in him, I can move from merely swapping love to beginning to give love. Now, I think the tragedy is, though, all of us vacillate. We're Christians. Sometimes we're very selfish. Sometimes we're living in a good swapping situation, and sometimes we move to that level of genuine gift love, but it's back and forth, loving and being loved. Klein, what does it mean to love? Well, since love is an action verb, let's look at some actions that are involved in loving someone. First of all, love is patience. As I try to think about patience, which means to bear with, to endure a situation or a person, I find that love is acceptance. It comes to the place that it looks at another person and says, I love you, not tolerate you. I accept you for who you are and where you are. Toleration basically says, I do not like what you're doing, but I'll put up with you because it's my Christian obligation. But it always makes you feel inferior, beneath me. Acceptance says, I may not approve of what you're doing, but I accept you as my equal. That means that the organized person says to the spontaneous person, I may wish you were more organized, but I give you the right to be spontaneous and to be just as worthy as I am. The neat-nick looks over at the casual person and says, I accept you as my equal. You have just as much right to be casual as I have to be neat. I accept you as an equal with your differences, but also with your warts, your imperfections. I think one of the hardest truths for us as Christians to realize is, with God, sin is sin. On one occasion, I was doing a Bible study, as a matter of fact, in Oklahoma City, on the practical aspects of faith. I had not planned on saying this, but felt led of the Spirit to say what I said. I was trying to impact people on the fact that faith overcomes worry, and to try and get them to face the reality of what worry is, sin. And I made this statement. What does it cost God to forgive the sin of adultery? The last drop of the blood of Jesus Christ. What does it cost God to forgive the sin of worry? The same price. A lady had been nodding agreement with everything I said until I came to that place, and then her head began to go from side to side, no, no, no. And as soon as the closing prayer was finished, she came at me with fire in her eyes and said, don't you understand? Worry is natural. I said, ma'am, so is adultery. They both come from the natural man. They both have their source from the same place. Now, when you and I come to that place that we really began to understand that, It moves us to the place where we give to each other a sense of acceptance that says, I may not always approve of what you do, but I accept you for who you are. When I first began working with singles, I was encountered by one of our ladies who said, Craig, we've got a problem. No, you have a problem. And she began to share how that there was a lady who was coming to the class who was on occasion spending the night with this guy that she was dating, and she said, you're approving of it because you're allowing her to come to class. I said, no. I'm not approving of what she is doing. But you see, every Sunday morning when we come to that table to talk and to share about Christ, I look upon myself and her as two sinners meeting together to find out where there is forgiveness. She has her problems, but I also have mine because I am not perfect either. When you and I come to that place, it'll change our attitudes because we will no longer try to change one another. I think one of the biggest problems in many marriages is you look over the flock and say, that person is so-and-so, they've got this quality and this quality, I like this, but they got these faults, but that's all right, I'll marry them and change them. And so the man marries and he said, well, I'm going to change her. Ladies, I understand why you frequently do this, because you look out over the males in your generation and believe there's been a real crop failure. All there are a few nubbins, are chunks of coal, and to use John Anderson's term, you're an old chunk of coal, but there's a diamond in there. And so you get married, where you say, oh, good, I'm going to change that old diamond, I'm going to cut, and I'm going to shape, and I'm going to polish. And so you marry, saying yes on an equal level. But the next day, you become mama, and he becomes son. And one day he awakens and realizes he's got two mothers and no lover to have sex with his mother's incest. So he goes looking for a lover. That's a harsh statement, but some of you know exactly what I'm saying, because that's what's happened to you. It hurts. But you and I must come to realize that love saying, I love you, says, here are some areas that you may consider, but I will never play God in your life and say, this is where you've got to change. Listen to me. If you're married and the mates are saying, yes, mother, or yes, daddy, that is a red lantern of warning saying, be careful. This change will. Love says, I accept you for who you are. Love is also kind. I try and understand what kindness is, and basically, kindness is nothing more than being aware of other people. There are several things that bother me. One is to see a bumper sticker on a car that says, don't tell me how to drive it, it's mine. I want to say maybe the car is, but the highway is not, because courtesy in driving is driving with an awareness of the other drivers. The ones in front of you, the ones behind you, the ones coming towards you. When you get in your car, if you are kind, you're constantly aware of every other car on the road. Another thing is to be walking behind somebody going into a building. You're half a step behind them, and they walk through, and what do? They let these big old doors close, and there you are caught where either you have to go on forward and boom, or stop and let them close, and then start all the way. Why? Well, sometimes we're just not aware. We don't care. The other times is we're afraid that if I stop and hold the door for you, you'll get in line ahead of me at McDonald's or wherever it might be. Why can't we be thoughtful enough to stop and hold the door and let the person go in, and then they stop and let us get in line ahead of them? So it's kindness is being aware of the other person and letting them know that I'm thinking about you. It may be a simple card. It may be a flower. It may be a gift, but it's a way of saying, you were on my mind. I was thinking about you. I was aware of you. Love being kind is also very sensitive. It's sensitive to the other person and where they are and what's going on in their world. Years ago, I read an article in Reader's Digest of a couple that had a prearranged signal. If he had a bad day, he wore his hat on sideways when he came in. If she had a bad day, she wore her apron on backwards. And when they walked in and saw the sign, says, uh-oh, TLC, don't bring up anything critical, anything destructive, be careful for a while. Hey, my wife knows that there are sometimes she can say something to me, and I'll respond in love and understand what she's saying. There are other times she may say the same thing, and it'll so put me down because of where I am that she just backs up and leaves alone. Love, being kind, is aware of the other person and where they are at that moment, and tries to reach out and touch them at the point where they are. Have you ever noticed where Jesus met people? Where they were. He said, now you come to me, when you get where I want you, then I'll meet you. He was always aware of people. And I think that's the key of kindness. I think of that awareness that he had on several occasions. On one occasion, he was walking down the road, stopped and looked up a tree, says, Zacchaeus, come down. He was aware of Zacchaeus, even though Zacchaeus was wearing the tree. Another time, he was walking through a crowd of people, and someone reached out and touched him, and there was healing that went out of his body. He stopped and said, who touched me? He was aware. Are you with me? Kindness is being aware of other people, not turning them off, but constantly seeking to be aware of other people, which gives them a sense of significance. Instead of being ignored, I see you. Mike was sharing with me recently how that he was visiting at the state convention. A preacher friend of ours saw him. Mike said he didn't want to interrupt because the man was talking to some other people. But this man, with his kindness, which I attest he has, stopped, excused himself from the conversation, and walked over and just said, hey, I want to say, how you doing? Kindness is being aware of another person. It is thoughtfulness. Love, though, is also not jealous. You see, jealousy is an attempt to possess another person. And whenever I possess a person, I make them an object and thus destroy them. Stop and think about that. My wife and I relate as husband and wife. And I use the term my wife, but she does not belong to me. She belongs to God only. We relate in that relationship. But I must never possess her, because in so doing, I will destroy her. Wait a minute, Clarence. What about that statement in Exodus where it talks about God being a jealous God? The Hebrew word would best be translated zealous. But I want you to picture something here. There's a difference between God's relationship to man and our relationship to our fellow man. You see, God owns us because he created us. Therefore, we do belong to him, and he has the right to possess us. Now, in his right to possess us, he is zealous not for his sake, but for our sake. See, I do not believe God hurts when we violate his law because we've broken his law. He's saying, you broke my law. It's an attitude of he hurts because he knows we are going to be hurt. And he hurts with us like a parent hurts with a child. Love is not jealous, because when I possess a person, what I'm doing is trying to force them into a relationship, force them to be what I want them to be, and that totally destroys the relationship. I'll ask you a question. When is a bird in a bush better than a bird in your hand? When you have taken the bird in your hand and literally squashed the life out of that bird by possessiveness. I've seen people's love killed by jealousy of women. But we're jealous. Listen to me. Jealousy does not come out of love. It roots in our own insecurity, our own lack of faith, our own lack of a healthy self-love. I now live in Texas, but I was reared in South Louisiana. And South Louisiana has one thing bigger than even Texas. That's mosquitoes. When I was about 14 years of age, I was camping one night. And during the night, I was awakened by two mosquitoes talking. One mosquito said to the other mosquito, shall we eat him here, or shall we take him out into the swamps and eat him? The second mosquito said, we better eat him here, because if we take him out into the swamps, the big mosquitoes will get him. Now, the story I know is ludicrous, but it makes a point. How many of you single, when you meet this one guy that's really a winner, run and just do everything with the crowd, or do you have a tendency to kind of keep him away from the crowd because you're afraid that there may be one down there that's got more looks or more money or more personality, drive a better car, whatever it is, and get him from you? You see, if you've got to hold him with a noose, remember what a noose is: an instrument of death. On the other hand, love, being what it is and being kind, and sensitive never provokes jealousy. I think all of us at times can be down on ourselves or down emotionally, and that person we love can begin to do that which normally would not even a favor. But at that precise moment, it would cause us to respond in a negative way. And love, being what it is, sees that person where they are, and therefore does not insist upon their freedom, as Paul says, but is always aware of the other person and where they are in their lives. Love is not jealous. Love does not boast. It is not always seeking credit for what it does. It's always wanting to love. Therefore, it cares not who gets the credit. It cares only that the person is experiencing the gift of love. I think true love is the ability to give anonymously. But so many of us are busy swapping love. For instance, Christmas time. See, I think Santa Claus teaches us an inferior concept of love. You know why? Santa Claus says, if you're good, I'll give you a present. If you're bad, I'll give you a switch. And too many children grow up believing that God loves us like Santa Claus does. That's the reason why we believe that God can't love us if we're bad, because Santa Claus doesn't. Love reaches out to that person in its loving concern and says, this is your need, I'm going to meet it. I was counseling with a couple. She says, my husband doesn't love me, he's only concerned about himself. In the dialogue of the conversation, one issue came out was, she said, he never spends any time with me. He said, don't you understand, I'm doing it for you? You know, I've got the business, and I get up at 4:30 in the morning, and I go into Houston, I get there at 6 o'clock, I open the place of business, I'm there until about 6 o'clock in the evening, I drive home, I get home, and we supper, and by 7:30 I'm tired, I've got to get up at 4:30, so I go to bed, but look, I'm doing it for you so I can give you this nice big house. And all these material things, and she looked at him and said, you're not doing it for me, you're doing it for yourself so you can prove to your dad that you can make that business, which you bought from him, a success. That you were okay. She said the real kicker, though, was this. For Christmas, she wanted an $85 guitar. That's not an expensive guitar. Was not that they did not have the money. He gave her a $5,000 mink coat. She said, I don't want a mink coat. I live in Houston, Texas. It's too hot to wear a mink coat. The only time you wear one down there is to brag. And that's why you gave me the coat, so you could brag how successful you are. If you loved me, you would have seen that I would much rather had the guitar. But you would not have gotten the credit, right? You've not gotten the glory of being so successful. Love does not boast. It reaches out in its own way to give to a person. I will never forget one day watching a telespot commercial on TV sponsored by the Catholic Diocese. There was a man walked in the room and saw a nun caring for a person with leprosy. He said, I would never do that. He turned and said, neither would I. Then after about 20 seconds of silence, she said, love will. When you love, you'll reach out at that point of need because you care not about what pride you get out of it or boasting about it. You care about the person's needs being met. Love is not arrogant. It is not proud, I guess is a modern day way of putting it. Love always acknowledges its equality with another person. Love acknowledges its own humanity, its own deficiencies, and does not get to that place where it feels superior to another person. One of the things that concerns me about some Christian marriages today, especially in situations where maybe one has become a Christian after they married and the other person is not yet a Christian, and that is that self-righteous attitude of looking down on that person and saying, well, I'm a Christian. Does that draw a person to Christ, or does that have a tendency to push him away from? I see that so often as I relate to people. I'm thinking of one of my counselees. She is involved in a charismatic Catholic church. He's Jewish. And he's been on such a guilt trip for so long because of some of her pressures that I've had to help her overcome that in order that she can love him. And seeing that transformation take place, as she came to the place that she did not feel more smug or more superior. It's never proud and arrogant of feeling like I am the boss. In relationships, so often you find power struggles to see who's going to be the boss. And I tell you something, whenever you get into that power struggle of who's going to be boss, you're going to lose. And our seminar for couples, I tell couples that if you are going to have a good marriage, you've got to learn the secret of a good argument. Couples that tell me they never argue, I look and say, hey, is one of you dead or are you lying? Because whenever two people come together with conflicting ideas, there is a meeting of the minds and there is some disagreement. There's an argument. The secret of a good argument, though, is not that somebody comes out a winner, because if one comes out a winner, the other one comes out a loser. The secret of a good argument is you come to an understanding and then both feel like they've won. It's not, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm boss, you're slave. It's, we are in this together, we're a team, and we've got to work together to work it out. Love has that feeling of compassion so that it never gets to the place that it feels superior to or better than the other person. Love does not manipulate. I think one of the worst books ever written is written by a man that I deeply admire, as a matter of fact, who has had a tremendous influence, humanly speaking, upon what I'm doing in my life right now. But the book is entitled, How to Manipulate Your Mate, by John Drakeford. I know it's coming out of the school of behavior modification. The idea is that you've got to help that person modify their behavior style so that they can be where they ought to be. But here's the tragedy of manipulation. Manipulation presupposes that you know what is right for another person. That's plain God. I don't always know what is right for my wife, because I'll be honest with you, sometimes what I think is right is wrong. It's my own selfishness getting in the way. But there's another interesting thing I find in it. God, who does know what is right for us, chooses not to manipulate. God will never do anything that violates man's freedom of choice, because God knows that the moment he takes away freedom of choice, he makes us robots, and therefore absolves us of any responsibility. Love will say, here's some things that I think you need to consider. Love, in its assertiveness, is say, if I were in that position, I would think about doing it this way or this way. But it doesn't say, this is the only way to do it, or this is the way you do it, or it does not manipulate them very subtly to get them to do what you want them to do. I've heard so many ladies say, Clyde, don't you understand? A good mother teaches her daughter how to wrap her husband around her little finger. We're getting close to a very dangerous situation. Frequently in weekend seminars, when we have time for question and answer between the sessions and the units, just before we begin this unit, I'll ask if there are any questions, and if they're not immediately somebody responding with a question, I'll say, listen, anytime I do a seminar and ask if there are questions and there are no questions, it means one of two things. Either I have done such a thorough job that I've answered all conceivable questions before you asked them, or you've been asleep, knowing that it's impossible for me to answer all the questions to prove that you've not been asleep when somebody asks a question. Normally somebody will throw up their hand and ask the question. Now, I do that at that point for a very simple reason. I want to show how often we manipulate through guilt. That's a guilt manipulator. And yet we do it all the time and then wonder why they come to resent. Salesmen learn how to do it very quickly. If you love your children, you want them to have every advantage possible, so you know they need to have this set of encyclopedias or this computer or whatever it is, and we do it one with another. We manipulate through guilt, and I'm saying love does not manipulate. It advises, it shares, it gives dreams, but it recognizes that ultimately that person must choose. And if I'm trying to manipulate them to get them to do what I want them to do, I'm playing God. That's not love. Love does not manipulate. Love is not easily angered. In the book of Exodus, where this phrase first appears in the Hebrew, it's a very interesting word. The Hebrew word literally means long of nostrils. You got the picture? Long of nostrils. Now to understand this, you've got to understand what happens when you put two bulls in a pasture. They butt heads to find out who's the king bull. The hard head gets the choice of the cows and the other gets the leftovers. But before they butt heads, what do? They snort and paw the ground. All right, long of nostril means it takes a long time for a snort to get out. Can I give you the New Testament parallel of that verse? It says, love covers a multitude of sins. It overlooks it. It covers it with love and says, oh, they got this law and this law and this imperfection. I love them. Therefore, I'm going to tell them, but I'm going to leave it to God to change them. Can I give you the modern day version of it? It simply means love don't nag. Now, some of us, in all honesty, must admit that we play God with each other so often that we see this little flaw and we just say, if you just change that, oh, Clyde, I don't nag them every time they do it. But do you give them that look? They're the game. I mean, you can give them a thought, and every time they do it, you respond. Love says we tell them occasionally, but every time they do it, we don't express ourselves about it. So they did it again? Okay, love says, I love you, warts and all, whatever it might be. Love is not easily angered. Love is forgiving. It does not keep a record of wrongs suffered. I think the tragedy of too many of us is we play a game of one-upmanship. We keep score. You know, it's like Bill goes out and gets drunk, and there's the I got one coming. The next day she goes out and buys her new blouse. Or Bill goes out and gets drunk, and he got one coming. A couple of days later, does something else. A week later, does something else. Got three of them. Now she goes out and buys a whole new outfit. Have y'all seen that shirt, I don't get mad, I just get even? Have y'all worn that shirt? See, I think the picture of so many of us is this. We collect green stamps. Y'all remember this back in the days when we had green stamps? And what has happened is we've got three books full of green stamps. But now the green stamp store has gone out of business. So what we do is keep them in the glove compartment of our car, and every time we drive by where the green stamp store used to be located, we get mad. Now, we can't take it out on them, so we take it out on the other drivers, the people at work, the children, or whomever it is, because we got the green stamp and you haven't paid off, and I've got a record of it. I've got a record of everything wrong you've ever done, and I'm going to keep it there. I think that's one of the tragedies of the victim-villain concept of divorce. See, we're afraid that we're going to be judged the villain, so we keep a record. If it ever happens to me, I'm going to prove it wasn't my fault. I've done this and this and this and this. He did this and this and this and this. We keep that record. Do you know what love being forgiving does? It tears up the green stamp book. It burns them and says, hey, the debt's paid. See, forgiveness is not forgiving. Historically, you cannot forgive it. Forgiveness is caring enough to love the person in spite of their obnoxious behavior, in spite of what they've done. And the other thing is, you don't bring it up every time you get into an argument. Typical argument, what happens? You start dealing with an issue and then, well, I'm being defeated, so, but you always do so and so. Catch that phrase? When you brought that up, what you've done, I didn't keep it a record. You do the same thing. Now then what happens? The other person's put on the defense, and what happens now? But you always do it too. Well, it's your parents' fault. You see, if you had, and after a while, we began to attack each other's character and each other's heritage, and a few words come out, and it's kill. Love doesn't keep a record. Once it has been dealt with, it's been addressed, it's buried beneath the blood of Christ and left there forever, never again to be brought up. Love is forgiving. Love rejoices in the good and honestly and sincerely grieves when things go wrong.
That means love honestly rejoices for the former mate when he strikes all on the property he got in the divorce settlement. And love honestly and sincerely grieves for him when the one he left you for walks out on him. Is that the way you respond? God got him. I knew God was going to get him, and I was just waiting for God to do it. And if God doesn't do a good enough job, we'll tell everybody about it because we want to make sure everybody knows. Explore after see what happened to him. Love rejoices in the good and honestly grieves. And when it happens to him, you go to him and you say, you know, I really feel for you. Now, is there anything I can do? You need a shoulder to cry on? And you remember them in your prayers so that God uplifts them, picks them up so they don't have to drag down in the pit as long as you were down there? Are y'all beginning to catch what love is? Love is genuinely concerned about seeing good things happen to people. Even the people that you don't like, because you're supposed to love them. Love rejoices in the good. Love protects. The Greek word that I see when I see that picture is of a roof. Built over a person to protect them from the destructive elements. First of all, love protects from scorn and scoffing. I think one of the most cruel things you can ever do to someone you love is to put them down, especially in public. And yet we see so many people talking over battle acts, or, you know, embarrassing one another publicly, doing things like that, and laughing about it. I've gotten to the place that I have trouble watching situation comedies because most sitcoms are put down. You put one another down, you embarrass one another. I was in a grocery store one day. Man was checking out my groceries, and I could tell that he was one of the lesser managers. A lady came by, one of the other checkers, and he stopped doing what he was doing, checking my groceries, and began to just chew her out royally in front of me and everybody else there. After he finished, I turned and said, "Sir, she may have needed criticism. She may have needed some chastisement, but I don't think in front of all of us was the place to do it. And I want you to know, I did not appreciate it, and if you ever do it again in front of me, I will leave my groceries, I'll walk, and I'll find the manager, and I will personally write a letter up to the district manager, because I don't think that's what love is." And I think we need to start standing up. By the way, if you really want to understand why we are such masters at the put down, watch the comedies your kids watch on Saturday mornings. They're put down. They're putting each other down indirectly and directly. And I'm saying it's time we realize love does not put one another down. It builds one another up. It encourages one another. Also, love protects from the attacks of others. I think one of the tragedies I encounter so often in counseling is a couple is having problems. So what do? One of them runs home and tells mama. Now then the couple's trying to put it back together. And now then we got the in-laws and outlaws in the mess. I was counseling with a couple recently, and she'd gone home and told her mother, and the mother looked at her and says, "Listen, if you ever get back with him, don't you ever come back in my house. I will cut you out of my will." The more I see that, the more I'm convinced. In a divorce situation, the only persons who ought to know what really happened is God and one or two counselor types who could help you work through the problem and come to understand yourself in light of what happened and how you can grow from it. But going around telling everybody all the dirt is not love. Did y'all hear me? Now, I know that if you do this, be prepared, because invariably somebody's going to think, well, it must have been their fault. That's the way we are because of the victim-villain concept. But I believe that the sooner we learn to do that, the sooner we're going to learn what love is all about. It's encouraging and building one another up. Then again, love, trust. The word trust means faithful to, but more than that, it means believes in. It believes in the other person's abilities. It believes in them even when they are down, even when they have failed, even when they've made a mistake. And it becomes the encourager to that person. I'm thinking of when I was coaching flag football for 8, 9, 10-year-old boys. There was a young boy there who had a learning disability. He could hear, but he could not communicate always his thoughts. His dad had the same problem. I found out very quickly that if I criticized the guy, he quit. He gave up. But if every time he did it right, I pegged him on the back and encouraged him, he gave me everything he had. He tried even harder. By the end of the season, he was one of the most prolific workers on our team. He became an outstanding person because of that encouragement, believing in, even when he failed. A couple years ago, I was sharing with my pastor. We were rejoicing with some of the places we were going to share the seminar, some of the greatest churches in America. And we were elated, and he was extremely elated with me. He looked at me and said, "Clyde, do you remember the first time we met?" I looked at him and said, "Listen, I will never forget it." He looked and said, "You know, Clyde, the first time we met and you left my office," as he pointed to two chairs in the office, he said, "I'll be honest with you. I felt like you would forever be lost to the ministry, especially among Southern Baptists." With tears in my eyes, I turned to W.E. Broadway and said, "Had it not been for you and a few like you, you would probably be very right. But because you believed in me at the worst time of my life, when my life had been shattered by the tragedy of a divorce, that I felt like there was nothing left for me, no hope whatsoever, you encouraged me to come out here and begin a singles ministry. Help you." Just as a layperson, you encouraged me by saying, "Clyde, I'm going to be gone next Sunday. Would you preach for me?" And every time you were gone, you asked me to supply for you. As you saw me beginning the counseling, you said, "Clyde, they're going to need a place out here so people out here can come and relate to you." So you encouraged me to come out here and share by taking one of the offices. And I used the barred office out there for 3+ years because you believed in me. Because some other people believed in me enough to give me a chance to share some of the things that I believe God had given me. I was able to get up off the floor, feeling life was in hopeless, feeling like I had been shattered, and go forward. Gene Getz, pastor of the Fellowship Bible Church in Dallas, Texas, has a book entitled The Ministry of Encouragement. He talks about Barnabas, the least known probably of all the disciples, but the key thing about him was his purpose was encouragement. That's what his name means, the encourager. Do you see what I'm saying? Love encourages. When? When you're up? Yes. When you're down? Even more. But the tragedy of so many of us is we have a tendency to kick one another when we're down instead of encouraging. Love sees that person when they've fallen and reaches down to that person and says, "What can I do to help?" And most of all says, when the person feels that there is no hope, "I believe in you." Any of you have somebody boost you like that? I'd be very honest with you. There are a couple of people that I will treasure to my dying day because of that and their support, their encouragement. Love is optimistic. Have you ever noticed when teenagers get married or young people get married the first time? Man, they're so hopeful they can solve all their problems. They know it. Two can live as cheaply as one. I don't care what the problem is. They'll overcome it. Their parents have said, "Don't you see this problem?" They said, "Oh, we'll work it out. Don't worry." What happens as they get older? What happens after they go through the tragedy of a death or a divorce? What happens then? Have you noticed? They become pessimistic. "It won't work anyway. Why get married, Clyde? There are no good ones anyway. Nobody stays married anymore." Y'all with me? I think we need to find some hope. And I believe of all people, Christians ought to have hope because we know where God is. God's on his throne. God's going to win. So we have got to come back to the place that we have hope and we share hope with others. I watch the news on TV, total despair. I read the Bible, know God's on his throne. I get hope again. Can I give you my definition of hope? Optimism. Optimism is when an 80-year-old man marries a 75-year-old woman and immediately begins to look for a 3-bedroom home near an elementary school. But that's not hope. That's a miracle. That's what hope is. I was sharing with a man one day, he was talking about the ministry, and he was working with me. He says, Claude, I looked with pencil and paper, and I said, this, this, this. He says, I just can't make it. I said, he says, the only way I can make it is with a miracle. I said, that's right. That is what hope is, the belief in one of God's routine little miracles. Love ties into God, therefore it ties into those hopes, that hope that God can work a miracle. Love is optimistic, and love endures. Any love that has an ending is puppy love. Some of you have been told, hey, you still love Bill God, but he didn't love you. You've got to stop loving him. Don't. There's a book written on how to overcome the loss of a loved one by picturing that person as being so grotesque, you wonder how in the world they'd ever love him in the first place. Don't follow that principle. Because you see, the opposite of love is what? Hate. And hate will rob you of your capacity to love the ones you love. Well, Claude, what am I going to do? I still love the person, but I'm not supposed to hate him. How am I going to ever overcome it so I can go on with my life? Put them in the heavenly relationship. What's the heavenly relationship, someone? Brother and sister. That's what we're going to be in heaven. So you just say, heaven came down and glory filled my soul, and now I got a new brother, a new sister. And when you put them in the heavenly relationship, you can get excited, right? Why? How many of you really rejoice if your brother struck oil? Well, he's your brother, so you ought to rejoice, right? See, that's your brother, that's your sister. You could go to his wedding. How many of you plan on going to the wedding of your brother? You know, you get the picture? And when you began to see it in that realm, you realize that we're not talking about absurdities, we're talking about realities. Now, let's be honest, though. That which I've shared with you is I've given you a definition of love is 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, in practical, everyday terms. That's the ideal where I believe every one of us as Christians ought to strive. But most of us are like me. We strive, but we don't quite make it. I like to play golf. Don't play very often, but I admit I'm a bogey golfer. I watched one day of the Houston Open, followed a young man who's father is a preacher friend of mine in Fort Worth. Man, he hit that ball straight down. He missed a hole in one by half an inch. I got out the next week and I was going to, I saw how they did it. I hit that ball everywhere but where it was supposed to go. Hey, I was doing well. I had over 100 instead of a 70 as he had. But you know what? Just because I don't shoot par golf, I don't quit playing. Just because I do not measure up totally to where God wants me, I don't give up. My simple prayer is every day that God will help me to love better than I did the day before. And that is what love is. It's learning to love like God loves us. And as we love one another, we'll find a very interesting thing. The more you truly love, the more love comes back to you. Maybe not from the one you gave it to, but you can never outgive God. That's what love is.